Hey, Science Decoders, and welcome back. First and foremost, this will be our last episode of Season 2. And thank you guys so much for listening through the first two seasons. We know we had some bumps and bruises. We know we went through some wild rides and we learned some really interesting things. I'm happy to say that we'll be back for another season in Season 3. If you guys have any papers, any articles, or you yourself are scientists that want to be featured on this podcast and want to be able to communicate your results and discuss the science that you're doing and the importance that it has and the relevancy that it has, please feel free to reach out to us at SciWorthy.com. We've got listener information. We've got many ways in which you can engage with us as writers, editors, and as the podcast itself. You can send us an email or you can contact us through our website. We have seen a wonderful growth in our audience base, as well as the people that are listening and taking interest in what we're doing here at SciWorthy. So if you would remember to like, share, and subscribe this podcast, it would help our numbers out immensely. It would help you guys get better content, better information. The more we can get our name out there, the more it helps bring science to the forefront of everybody's mind and helps us break down these barriers and communicate its relevancy. The other very interesting thing that October means for us scientists is that it's Nobel Prize Month. On October 4th of 2021, Nobel Prizes this year were announced and awarded, so I'm going to list a few of those off. In chemistry, Benjamin List and David McMillan were awarded the Nobel Prize for their development of asymmetric organocatalysts. And basically, these are just molecules that are used as tools that helped revolutionize the construction or the building of other molecules, especially in pharmaceuticals. So these guys really helped revolutionize the pharmaceutical industry by making reactions easier, more available, and more specific so that we can target and create these really specific drugs for our bodies. This year, the Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded with one half jointly to Sekiro Manabe and Klaus Hasselmann for the physical model of Earth's climate, quantifying variability and reliably predicting global warming. So if you're interested in how physics and what physics has to say about global warming and exactly what this climate model was, look up the Manabe-Hasselmann model. Look up this paper. It should be available. And definitely take a read. And if you guys are interested in hearing us talk about it or write about it, please send it our way as well. And the other half of the prize was awarded to Giorgio Parisi for the discovery of the interplay of disordered and fluctuational physical systems from atoms all the way up to planets. So basically, the science that this researcher did was investigating the interplay of disorder. So what's called like spontaneous physics, or how things are always moving towards a greater disorder through what's called entropy, and how that causes fluctuations in science, both at the atomic level and at the planetary scale and everything in between. Interestingly, the Karolinska Institute Nobel Prize of Physiology or Medicine was awarded to David Julius and Artem Padaputane for their discoveries of receptors for temperature and touch. So these two researchers actually helped discover these two protein receptors in our body that help us distinguish between touch and temperature and how our body is responding to these environmental stimuluses. So if you're interested in that, also feel free to check out that paper. It's quite interesting. You know, other categories not listed here or explained here for Nobel Prizes include the Nobel Prize for Economic Sciences, the Nobel Prize for Literature, and the famous Nobel Peace Prize. So if you're interested in what the winners are for these, both past and present, go ahead and check that out on the Nobel Prize website. You can find just by Googling it. New and noteworthy on SciWorthy.com. We have an article talking about how water bears may be traveling on space rocks and what that may mean for life in space. We've got an article talking about these special mushrooms that can remove greenhouse gases from our atmosphere. And we have recently an article on studies done on how humans respond differently to physical touch. So if you're interested in any of these topics and many more, please check out our website at SciWorthy.com. Typically, we get a lot of questions about what it means to trust sources, and I know on our last episode we delved into that a little bit, but it's time for another tip on how to tell if a source is trustworthy or not. Our next tip is related to the one from the last episode, about who created the content, so if you missed that one, make sure to go back and check it out. To assess an article, book, or video, you can always ask yourself, what are their biases? You know, we all have biases. but it takes a tuned mind to recognize them, especially if they are biases you agree with. And we all have biases that we see every day that we do agree with. When you agree with internet content, it is really easy to miss your ideological blind spots. It's really easy to miss your ideological blind spots and convince yourself what the person is saying is true. Now, an example of an ideological blind spot is something like a predisposed belief or a perspective that you share coming in. Now, many times those perspectives and those beliefs can be good things, but when we're really looking at something logically, we have to work hard to remove those from our mind and really see what the logic and the evidence in front of us are giving. And in many times myself, as both a Christian and a scientist, I do have to suspend some of my beliefs in order to move forward and in order to logically think about the evidence in front of me. One big way to tease out what someone's bias is by their tone that they use in the article, the book, or the video. Does the article, book, or video appeal mainly to emotions? Are they making appeals to these beliefs that you have founded in anecdotes or in personal experience? Or are they making a self-consistent, rational argument? Well, there's nothing wrong with considering emotions, personal experiences, and previous beliefs when making an argument or coming to a conclusion. It's important that that conclusion also stays consistent once you remove those personal beliefs, emotions, and perspectives. So it must be self-consistent, it must be rational, and it must be logical. Otherwise, it's not a good argument. Do these people, when they speak to you, have an agenda? Or do they seem like they're making an honest effort at weighing multiple perspectives? I think the answers to these questions can help you determine whether a source has bias and what type of bias that may actually be. I've got one more tip about how to detect biases, but you'll have to tune in next week for the rest to hear it. So on today's episode, we're going to be talking a little bit about life on other planets. Shocker. Nah, we love that topic here at SciWorthy.com. Earth is the only known planet to host life, but there are plenty of places that still appear devoid of life, even on Earth. Extreme environments such as the frozen landscapes of Antarctica, the barren deserts of South America and Africa, and the salty, chemically rich environments of thermal vents found under the oceans have begun to show signs of microbial life. Researchers in this field of science go to these extreme environments and collect samples of the environment and survey them, looking for signatures of life that is or once was there. Sometimes, if they're lucky, scientists actually find bacteria and other microbes happily living in these extreme environments. As you can imagine, the way in which these samples are handled is extremely important. Sterility is of the utmost importance. If these samples are contaminated in any way, then any signs of life found in these samples come from outside sources, and it becomes difficult to make any sort of claim on life in seemingly unlivable conditions. Interestingly, the search for life on other planets works much in the same way. Scientists use tools on rovers to help search for chemical signs of life, called biosignatures. NASA even has plans to attempt to recover and return samples of Martian rocks so that scientists can inspect them for signs of life. One of the first samples was collected this very week, and on our previous episode with Dr. Svetlana, we talked a lot about what the process looks like and what some of the names of these missions are. So if you're interested in hearing updates, go on to nasa.gov and check out their projects. Finding life in these extreme environments on Earth provides scientists with hope that life may be found elsewhere someday. If Mars at one time did have life, then it's possible that slowly over time, life adapted to the planetary changes that made Mars what it is today. While there have so far been no signs of life on the surface of the planet, it is possible somewhere beneath the desolate face of Mars or the polar ice caps that we find life. Today on the pod, we're going to be talking to Dr. Armando Azua Bustos on his recent paper, Inhabited Subsurface Wet Smectites in the Hyper-Arid Core of the Atacama Desert as an Analog for the Search for Life on Mars. And this paper specifically focuses on how he went in and observed clay sediments and found bacteria living deep below one of the driest and most lifeless places on Earth, and how this might inform our research for the search of life on Mars in the future. So stay tuned. Welcome back, Science Decoders. It's me, Justin, and I'm here joined with Dr. Armando Arsura Bustos. He is a scientist in Spain. Armando, thank you so much for joining us. So Armando, in your paper that we're discussing today, you talked about the Atacama Desert and this wet subsurface of rock called a smectite, in which is really rich in clay. What inspired you to look for life below the surface of this oldest and one of the driest deserts in the world?
Well, that's actually a very good question, because in this case, nothing inspired me. This was a true discovery. And let me explain. This was 2017. And this discovery took place in a site called Yangai, which is a well-known site in the middle of a hyperarid called Atacama Desert, because it was the first time that NASA came there in 2003 and proposed that with the findings of that site that Atacama could be a good analog model of Mars. Since then, many research teams from around the world have been coming to Yangai at the point that, for us at least, again in 2017, we deemed that there wasn't nothing more interesting to report on Yangai, right? So in this case, we're sampling some other regions in nearby areas of Yangai, and one of our international colleagues, I don't remember, I think he was coming from Mexico, he knew that we were coming to the desert, and he asked us, well, can I go with you guys, of course? And because I want to take samples of Yangai. Yeah, sure, we can stop there. So actually, we were waiting for this colleague to take samples of the surface soils of Yangai, and we were with another colleague just watching him work. That when at some point we start noticing that he was taking out some dark material, and that is interesting, because it's something like look wet, and when we get closer, we clearly see something like that looked like wet clays. And that was very striking, because again, Yangai was before reported as one of the driest places on Earth. So how come you just dig a little bit and no longer than the length of your arm in order to find wet clays? So we came back to that site again, and actually we did find that that was a type of clay called smectite. It's a type of clay. And because of being a clay, and for a reason that we still don't know, it was holding water. And water is the key factor in the Atacama that can change the way that life is able to inhabit any particular site. So we saw, well, Yangai is well known for being really dry for life, but if you have water, maybe this is a completely different situation. So coming back to your question, it was just pure luck that this colleague wanted to go to Yangai, and we're just watching him doing his work, and we noticed that, and then we tested that, and then we found that those were actually wet clays. In all of this region, even if you had a little water, considering the water that this clay were holding, you can only expect and find microbial life. These regions are so dry for any type of life form that when you find life, you are just talking about different type of microorganisms. So we found a number of different microorganisms living in that wet clays.
You had mentioned too in your paper and just now that these types of bacteria that you found are also typically found in high saline environments, so very salty environments, and high UV environments. So the type of the bacteria maybe didn't so much surprise you, but did you observe anything unique that you did see?
Yes, there was an unexpected diversity of microorganisms there, not only different type of bacteria, but also different types of archaea. Those were reported as the type of microorganism that usually lives in highly saline environments. And that makes sense, because where we took the samples and where we found the wet clays, it was supposed to be an ancient salt pan. So you find all the salt from the salt pan, but then you have the addition of water that we suspected that was coming from some somewhere below. We found a number. It wasn't really unexpected in the type of bacteria, but it was unexpected on the number and the fact that you were finding life there. Because if you go to the surface soil of Yangai, maybe you find nothing. And I usually joke with my colleague that if you want to wash your hands in those regions, you have to just take the few top centimeters of the soil, because the soil is sterile due to the hyperaridity, due to the high UV radiation, which in the case of Atacama has value among the highest measured all around the world. Having this also soil very high, being also very saline, and also having a number of different chemicals like perchlorate that are really highly oxidant. So the conditions are so harsh at the surface of the soil that they make them almost sterile. But if you go a few centimeters below, up to this clay layer, which had water, that made the whole difference. Then you find a number of different microorganisms. So the true discovery there was not as much as the diversity as finding them at all there. I would say that maybe the uniqueness is coming from how those bacteria look in the soil. Because if you use a number of different microscopic techniques, you will find that if you stain them with a particular stain that is able to see the DNA of this bacteria in the soil, so you will get to see their cells shining compared with the background of the soil, you will get to see that you will see a kind of halo surrounding group of cells. And when you have that observation, you know that this is probably caused by a substance that I call exopolymeric substances or extracellular polymeric substances, which are a network of sugars or another compound that surround the cells, which are typically made when different cells are collaborating with each other. It's like having a small town surrounded by a wall. So by seeing this EPS, the exopolymeric substances, it suggested that whatever the species that were there, they may have been collaborating with each other in order to survive in that particular site. So yeah, the diversity didn't surprise me much, maybe the amount, but the fact that with that observation, you could tell that maybe these bacteria were, and archaea maybe may have been collaborating in order to survive in that site.
And so you mentioned when you were actually analyzing your samples, you used materials and methods, and even one specifically fluorescence microscopy. Can you tell us a little bit more about the materials and methods you used and how you handled these samples?
Well, it's always tricky to work with the samples of these regions because you have to think that you are at the limit of sterility or at the limit of habitability. So you have to be really careful, and we have developed a number of techniques to work in the sampling process so not to contaminate the site with our own bacteria or the bacteria of our instruments. So we established a number of protocols in order to clearly be sure that we were sampling only whatever you were taking from that site and nothing else. It's completely different from going, for example, to a rainforest in Costa Rica, right? Here, you have to think that even if you step in one side, maybe you are contaminating it. So, for example, things like having the wind in front of your face all the time, so you're not, throwing anything into the site. And of course, we're working with everything sterilized. And in the case of the site, it wasn't the case here in Yangai, but in the case of other sites, which are much drier than Yangai, we even use this biosuits in order to not be sure that we'll not be contaminated with anything. In this case, we wanted to observe the bacteria in order to assess the population numbers. So, as I said, you use this stain. There's a number of different stains that you're going to that stick to the DNA, and when you put it in a particular type of microscope and you activate it with UV, different type of UV lights or different type of radiation, you can see that as a response they cause fluorescence. So you see light coming from where these stains are, in this case, attached to the DNAs of the bacteria. So you can see the cells of the bacteria shining and then get to see, well, if it is that happening, it's because I have DNA, and that's because I have a cell there. So that again was in order to assess the bacterial number of the soil, but in addition, it also gave us an idea of how they were structured in the soil. As I commented, forming these little aggregations surrounded by this EPS suggested that there may be some form of collaboration of the bacteria in those small aggregations.
So obviously, sterility was very important to make sure that there was no outside contamination. And it sounds like you guys took that very seriously. And then as for specific detection, I know firsthand how easy and reliable it is to stain DNA and then to shine some UV light on it. And then you can actually visualize it. And that really points towards there being life and there being something more in there. And so I think that's pretty incredible. Now, you also in your paper talked a little bit about the metabolisms of the life you found, more specifically about possible biosignatures in this type of rock, in this smectite you could find. What were you able to identify when looking at the biosignatures?
First, we had to say why we were looking for biosignatures, right? Because we already knew that life was there. Usually, try to find biosignatures in this kind of environment in order to understand how would you look for evidence of life in similar environment outside Earth. In this case, in Mars, right? So on Mars, you will not have the entire suite of equipment and techniques that we have on Earth. Okay, let's think about how a rover on Mars would be able to see that there are bacteria under the surface here. So for that, you look for different type of biosignatures. In our case, we are looking for a particular type of biosignatures, which are lipids. The compound that, for example, make all the type of cell membranes, independent of any life form you can think, they all have membranes, they all make of lipid. And the nice thing of lipid, they are really hard to destroy in time. If you want to go, for example, to look for evidence of life on Mars, it would be a good idea to look for lipids, since they conserve some of their structure in time really well. And if you add that you are looking for lipids in clay, that is even better, because the clay structure itself, which is formed by a number of different layers, they can trap this biosignature inside those layers of clay and protect them further, right? So we're looking for different type of biosignature in order to see how a rover on Mars would see this same thing, the same finding here, and what those different type of biosignature could tell us about the bacteria we know they are there. So we did find the expected biosignatures that are a little bit coming from different type of bacteria, which in addition, this type of bacteria are known for their metabolism. So you can see, I have the typical biosignature of sulfate reducing bacteria, etc., etc. And so we find the biosignature of the type of microorganisms of bacteria and archaea that we knew by using other techniques that were in the site, but also interestingly, we found a number of different biosignatures of things that were not in the list of different bags that we were able to find there. One beautiful example of that is that a typical biosignature that is coming from the lipid membranes of cyanobacteria and even higher plant, which is pristine, right? So as you may expect, since this clay layer was about 30 centimeters in the soil surface, you didn't have any light. So if you don't have light, you wouldn't expect to find any type of microorganism using light, like cyanobacteria or microalgae, etc. But that we could still find the presence of the lipid coming from their membrane. So when the result that we were seeing in this case is that we're seeing the molecular remnants of the cyanobacteria that are there in this case in the surface of the soil, because in the surface of the soils there is a number of rocks composed by sodium chloride, halite. Inside those rocks, there were a number of cyanobacteria. So we think we were detecting the molecular remnants that were going from the surface into the soil depth in order to see them there. And also, maybe we're also seeing the molecular remnant of the lipids of the cell membranes of the plants that may have inhabited these areas, maybe, who knows, hundreds of millions of years ago, but also the molecular remnant of whatever was in the surface that was able to reach that depth.
And, you know, I think that's a really acute observation, and that's something that you always have to keep in mind, right? You need some sort of background control, and I think it takes a little thinking outside the box to think, hey, there may have once been life here, and that may be contributing to some of the signals and the molecules that we are seeing.
That's a very interesting what you mentioned, because, for example, when we start finding pristine, so why should we expect pristine here? So, we're thinking maybe in our time frame, but let's expand this to the geological time, and then it can make sense that we're looking and we're finding pristine, because who knows when did this arrive into the site, right? So the data itself is unveiling itself, so to say, in order to test your knowledge and your imagination, also in order to try to understand what you're finding.
Now, with all these experiments and all the different angles you approach this at, what were some common pitfalls or issues that you found yourself coming against while doing this research?
And that was a lesson for me. Expect the unexpected. Because as I said, we have been, up to that day, we haven't visited Yungay for scientific reasons for many years, because we thought, everything has been done here, just to find this really interesting finding, really unexpected finding, because what we found that in this really harsh environment, really dry, with high UV radiation and all what I just said, you just need to dig a few centimeters in the soil surface to find life and happily living in the right proper conditions, complete isolation for what's going on outside. that was an interesting lesson. I was like, to learn to say, well, don't take everything for granted. You got to still find really interesting findings in this case, in well-known sites, at the point that this particular report made it to scientific report. And also through the years, it had been one of the top 100 most downloaded papers of in time. It happened in 2019. It happened in 2020 again. So yet the only pitfall I would detect here is this, don't make paradigms. I know everything from this side, nothing to discover. Wait, look carefully, look for changes, et cetera, et cetera.
So how do you hope that this science or your research will make an impact in the current and future rover missions, as well as future astrobiology research?
Well, actually, my hopes turn into reality by a very simple fact. When the principal investigator of the ExoMars mission that is going to be sent to Mars, when the day after this got published, he wrote me to congratulate me on this paper because it was a really nice evidence something similar may be happening on Mars. Because you may know, the ExoMars mission will carry a drill that will go into the soil subsurface in order to find evidence of life in places where we know they are rich in different type of clays, including hematite. So if on Earth you are finding in an analog model that if you dig at the proper place, you can find biosignatures and even life itself really happy living there, why cannot dream of something similar in the case of Mars, right? It was like a proof of concept of sending an entire mission to Mars to the proper place in order to try to search for something similar.
So realistically speaking, does your own research and your own results make you any more hopeful that we'll find either evidence for former life or current life on Mars?
At least biosignature, because as I said, if you look at the proper place and look for the proper biosignature, you will be able to find it. And in this case, who would expect to find life with no issues, living just a few centimeters from hell? So if that is the case here, why not expect something similar in environments like Mars?
Absolutely. It kind of goes back to that whole expect the unexpected thing, right? And that's kind of why we do what we do as scientists and go out there and ask questions and do research to just figure out the answer, whatever that may be. So last question for today. You know, I'm personally just curious, why'd you come on the podcast? And is there anything else that you'd like to communicate to our listeners who are out there right now?
Well, it's a personal issue for me because I think, and sadly it's not the case with every scientist that I know, that knowledge has no value if you don't share it, right? It has no value if you don't share it. So scientists to be very humble and always ready and open to explain what they have found to others. Otherwise, why doing science, right? Just to keep it among a circle of experts, for me, doesn't make much sense. I like to share with the general public what my findings are, what they mean, and where I'm going and where I have been in order to say, well, science is fun. And in this case, it can bring you surprises.
Well, Armando, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate all the thoughtful words and, you know, the work you've put in and this incredible discovery. And we look forward to see how it impacts future Mars studies, astrobiology, rover missions, and how informative and helpful it is for all of us trying to answer the question, you know, if there really is life outside of Earth. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for the invitation.
Hi, Gina here. Thanks for listening to Science Decoded. We want to thank our host with the most, Justin Dingman, as well as our behind-the-scenes team members, Osama Alien and Garrett Campion. Our channel artwork was designed by Tammy Whitsons, and our theme song was written and recorded by Graham Albright. We'd also like to thank our Patreon and local supporters. Without all of you, we couldn't do what we do. SciWorthy is an initiative of the 501c3 nonprofit Blue Marble Space. You can learn more at www.bluemarblespace.org.